or beneficial to the people in it, nor does it consider the harm that may be done to them by the veto. It's true that when we have several relationships, some may cause pain in others. Despite raising the issues, despite ongoing negotiation, the pivot partner may choose to remain in a relationship that one of her partners thinks is harmful. If you are the partner who might want to issue a veto, consider stating boundaries for yourself instead. You could say, "The situation is degrading my happiness to the point where I can no longer imagine being happy if it continues. If you keep going down this course, I won't be able to remain in this relationship." Indeed, it's an important part of consent. You always have the right to withdraw consent for any reason. You never have to remain in a situation that hurts you. Issues of power and risk come up. If you have veto power and you say, "I cannot stay with you if you remain in this relationship," you know ahead of time that you will win this particular play. Your partner has promised you in advance, probably when his other partner was still hypothetical and not yet a real person, that if this scenario ever arose, he would choose you. Because you're pretty sure what the outcome will be, the risk for you in enacting a veto is lowered. You can deliver an ultimatum and still not lose the relationship. You do not have to shoulder the risk and vulnerability of saying you are prepared to leave and really mean it. In other words, the consequences of your actions, and thus the bar you need to reach before you issue an ultimatum, are lowered for you, giving you more power and less incentive to act in good faith. At the same time, all of that risk is unloaded onto the other partner. This shifting of risk, telling another person to bear both the normal risk that comes with any relationship, plus extra risk shifted from another relationship, is one of the things that makes vetoes unethical. If, on the other hand, you do not have veto power, the outcome is not predetermined. There is a chance that your partner will not break up with his other partner, so you have to accept the vulnerability of telling your partner, "I can't take this anymore. I will have to leave if you continue that relationship." You have to be sure. It seems to us that if you're ready to take a step as serious as ending another person's intimate relationship, it's fair to ask that you put as much on the line as they have. And then, without a veto, your partner has the opportunity to do what he believes will be best for him in the long run. What will bring him the most happiness? Rather than having to make a choice he may not want to make because it was agreed to long before a third real human being was involved. The people in the relationship remain more important than the relationship, including that third person. When the outcome is predetermined through a veto arrangement, she has no room to negotiate or to defend herself or her relationship. Maybe she even has a case for why she is a better partner for him than you are, and she should have the right to make that case. Even if you have a strictly hierarchical primary-secondary relationship, the ethical considerations of veto deserve some attention. Any relationship can end for any number of reasons. Not all relationships last. That's a fact of life. See chapter 22. But even when the primary partner in a hierarchical relationship decides he needs his partner's secondary relationship to end, the ethical thing to do is to involve the secondary partner in the discussion and allow her to respond to concerns. Practical problems with veto. Aside from ethical concerns, and aside from the pain and bitterness a veto may cause, veto arrangements present other practical problems you may not have thought of. For example, a veto arrangement that's justified by a bad past experience holds a bad actor's actions against a new person who never even knew him. Say your partner became involved with Bob last year, and Bob rained drama and chaos all over. If that makes you ask for a veto, then when Charles comes along, you're making him pay for the sins of Bob. You are perpetuating Bob's drama. Another problem is escalation. We can't, short of use of force, actually make a partner break up with someone. When we use a veto, even a mutually agreed upon veto, we are giving our partner a choice: break up with your other partner or else. The "or else" part is often left unspecified. Few veto negotiations include provisions for what might happen if the veto is ignored. But a veto can, in fact, be ignored. Then what? Veto creates a trust imbalance. The new person is often told, Trust us, we won't use this veto inappropriately. But what does this say to the new person? I want you to trust that I won't veto you inappropriately, but we have a veto arrangement because we don't trust you. Is it reasonable to ask someone we don't trust to trust us? On an even more pragmatic note, we observe that people who make the best partners in poly relationships, people who have experience with polyamory, have demonstrated good communication skills, are compassionate problem solvers with good conflict resolution skills, and have a high reputation in the community for these abilities, usually avoid anyone who has veto. So, by having a veto in place, you stack the deck toward relationship problems, because so many experienced poly people with good skills will avoid you. Both of us use "Do you have a veto agreement?" as a screening question with potential partners. If the answer is yes, it's a deal breaker. Alternatives to veto. People can become confused when talking about relationships without veto because they may have a mistaken notion that no veto means no input. Some new partners can indeed be damaging or even dangerous, and it's important to be able to speak up when you see problems. Think about right of consultation as an alternative to right of veto. You want conversation to open up, whereas a veto will end conversation. You need to be able to say, "I've got a bad feeling from the way he treated you there at the bus stop." Or, "I went online and I found he has a restraining order against him." And have that not perceived as a threat, but as useful information. Your partner needs to know you will go on to say, "So, please be extra careful, and I'd like it if you could phone home often." The most common justification we hear for veto power is that it is necessary to prevent a new partner from trying to break up the existing relationship. There certainly are people who will try to do this. They're common enough that the poly community has a name for them, cowboys or cowgirls, because they ride up hoping to rope one out of the poly herd. Unfortunately, veto treats all new partners as bad actors simply because some might be, and your partner isn't a delicate Grecian urn, an object to be stolen away by an enterprising burglar. Your partner is a person, and people can't be stolen. If some new shiny tries to steal him, he has to consent to being stolen. Veto or no veto, if he wants to stay with you, he will. So the real question is not, how can I protect myself from cowboys? The real question is, do you trust your partner to want to be with you, even if some cute young thing asks her to leave you? If someone says, "Run away with me," what do you think your partner will say? Trust isn't something most of us are taught when growing up. The conventional fairy tale tells us to find true love and we'll be happy ever after. It doesn't mention trusting our partners, even when we're afraid. It doesn't tell us how to assert good boundaries when faced with potential disrupting relationships. Committing yourself to trusting that your partner wants to be with you and will choose to be with you even if someone else tries to tug him away takes courage. Asserting good boundaries around your partner's other partners takes work. But in the end, your partner is going to make the choices he makes, whatever rules you put in place. So what other options do you really have? Solid boundary setting is another important tool in managing veto-free relationships. See Chapter 9. Your partner may choose a partner you don't particularly like to be around. She may choose a partner who encourages her to make choices that hurt you. At these times, you need to be able to set clear guidelines about what you will and won't accept within your own relationship. You do not need to spend time with someone you don't like. If you feel uncomfortable or unsafe with a certain person in your home or your bed or around your children, you have a right to and should set limits about who you will permit in your space. Of course, your partner also has the right to choose a different living arrangement if your boundaries become unworkable for her. If you expect certain standards of behavior, to be told the truth, for example, or to have plans reliably kept that the other relationship is interfering with, you can express these expectations to your partner without managing the other relationship. And of course, if you are in a relationship without veto, it is especially important to respect the boundaries your partner sets around her body, her mind, her choices, and her space with regard to your other partners, even when they inconvenience you. Chapter 4, talked about the idea of self-efficacy, your belief in your own ability to make yourself heard and to positively affect your own situation. Veto can seem like a form of self-efficacy. But we believe self-efficacy lies in believing that if your partner's new relationship starts to go horribly wrong, you can talk about it and make yourself heard. Veto is an indicator of low self-efficacy. It is a way of saying, I don't believe I can get my partner to listen to my concerns unless I have a kill switch. The higher a person's self-efficacy, though, the less likely that person will enter a relationship with a veto provision in the first place. If you value the ability to have a say in your own relationships, you're unlikely to agree to give someone else ultimate authority over whether your relationship lives or dies. We talk more about setting boundaries with your partner's other partners in Chapter 23, on metamors, and about negotiating directly with your own partners in Chapters 6 and 7. Line item vetoes and force of drama. Many people who don't have a formally negotiated veto arrangement come up with ways to veto their partner's relationship anyway. If you see patterns like this, it's time for you and your partner to talk. Like most ways of getting our way when direct negotiation has failed, these can be emotional blackmail. First, there's the line item veto. That's when, on a case-by-case basis, you restrict what your partner can do with her other partners and when. Eventually, enough dates get cancelled or interrupted, enough activities curtailed, that the relationship withers and dies. You don't have to demand that your partner end the relationship in order to make it end. You just have to starve it of the resources it needs to thrive. Another form of veto by another name is what Eve likes to call force of drama. This is a weapon you can use when you don't want your partner to do something, like go on a date, continue a relationship, or engage in certain activity. But you have not been able to negotiate up front what you want. Your partner, after considering your input, has decided to make another choice. Go on the date. Continue the relationship. Do that thing. But instead of accepting your partner's choice, you make sure that it carries a price. You have an emotional meltdown an hour before that date, and he has to stay home with you. You send him anxious text messages every 5 minutes whenever he's with the partner you don't like. You keep making non-specific threats of disaster, emotional or physical, when he does what you don't want. As damaging as this behavior is, we often unintentionally reinforce it when it happens. We want to be there for our partners. We don't want to hurt them. And most of us don't really like conflict. If her objection to that thing I wanted to do is so important to her, I don't really need to do it, right? That one date really isn't so important. I can schedule another one. The problem is, people use this behavior because it works. It gets them what they want. Some people object to the use of the word drama, on the grounds that it's used to minimize and dismiss. In the sense we are using it, however, force of drama has another name, emotional blackmail. If you recognize what we're describing, either in your own behavior or in your partner's, you owe it to yourself and your partners to read the book Emotional Blackmail, listed in the resources section of the paperback and digital versions of this book. Of course, we think we have really good reasons every time we do it. None of us wants to believe that we're manipulating our partner, and we're very good at justifying our actions, even to ourselves. To the person conducting the line item veto or wielding force of drama, every instance seems necessary and justified, and everyone is allowed the occasional freak-out, outburst, or temper tantrum. But if this is happening on a regular basis, and if your partners are giving in to your demands simply to avoid dealing with your behavior, you may want to consider getting professional help to cope with your emotions. If your partner exhibits this kind of behavior often, if most of your decisions she doesn't like involve you paying an emotional price, or if her drama continues more than a couple of months into a new relationship, then you have a problem, a potentially serious one, with no easy solution. The two of you will need to learn more appropriate negotiation techniques that do not involve emotional threats. Point out the behavior to her and explain the effect it is having on your relationship. Consider reading Emotional Blackmail together and consider getting professional help from a poly-friendly counselor. If the behavior does not stop, you may need to consider ending the relationship. Pocket vetoes. A pocket veto is when you stop your partner from doing something you don't want her to do, simply by doing nothing. In polyamory, this usually comes in the form of, I'm afraid of X. Please don't do X until I stop being afraid. Sarah's story. An example of this involves Franklin's friend Sarah. Sarah was in a relationship with Owen, who was married to Kate. Sarah started a new relationship with Mark. Kate told Sarah that she didn't feel comfortable with Sarah having sex with Mark until Kate knew him better, and requested a 3-month waiting period for everyone to get to know each other before Sarah and Mark had sex. Sarah agreed, and 3 months passed. 3 very busy months, in which Kate never had time to get together with Mark. So at the end of the 3 months, Kate asked Sarah to wait another 3 months, since Kate hadn't had time to feel safe with Mark. Sarah and Kate were not even lovers. They simply shared a partner. We've known a few people who have been in relationships with monogamously inclined partners who agreed to a polyamorous relationship, but only after they felt secure in the relationship. That turned out to be never. Of course, if your reward for feeling secure is something you don't want, you don't have much incentive to ever feel secure. These relationships can last for years before ending. We know of at least one that has been going on for 6 years, the polyamorous partner still wistfully hoping that someday his monogamous partner will get there. We have talked of being judicious when you start new relationships, that perhaps it's better not to bring in new partners when an existing relationship is in crisis, just after a major life upheaval, or when serious mental health issues are erupting, to name a few. The trouble is that this idea of poly-readiness can become a pocket veto if it does not include a clear statute of limitations. If you need time to work through an issue, get used to a new partner, or adjust to the idea, then agree to a time limit on it. If the time limit expires and you still want to say no, or if you want to renew the time limit, understand that you have crossed into pocket veto territory. That is not, in and of itself, a bad thing, provided you're okay with using a veto. But recognize that this is what you're doing. Questions to ask yourself. The questions around veto fall into 3 categories. Those for people who want to have a veto over their partner's relationships. Those for people who are considering giving veto power to another. And those for people who are considering becoming involved with someone whose partner has a veto. If you want your partner to give you veto power over his or her other relationships, under what circumstances do I feel it's appropriate for me to use it? Who do I think should have the final say in deciding whether a relationship ends? Why? What do I believe will happen if I ask a partner to end another relationship, and he or she says no? Why will that thing happen? Do I trust my partner to consider my needs and well-being in his decisions on whether to stay in a relationship that is hurting me? Why or why not? If not, what can I do to improve that trust? Do I trust my partner to make good decisions about whom she starts relationships with? Why or why not? What might the consequences be if she makes a poor decision, and how might I deal with those consequences? How do I use the word veto to describe something other than an ability to unilaterally end a partner's relationship? For example, when I give input to my partners about how I feel about their other relationships. If so, why? Is there something about the word that reassures me in a way that words like negotiation and input do not? If you're considering giving your partner's veto. Am I prepared to bring someone I care about, or will come to care about, into a situation where I must dump them at someone else's will? Can I think of a way to make a new partner feel safe in a relationship with me under these conditions? Do I understand the needs my partner is seeking to meet by requesting veto? And have I considered alternative ways of meeting those needs? If you are considering starting a relationship with someone whose partner has a veto. If I start a relationship with someone who is already partnered, what kind of input do I feel it's reasonable for their other partners to have in our relationship? Do I feel safe opening my heart to someone who is given the power to end our relationship to someone else? 13. Empowered relationships. I've worked really hard to eliminate the words have to from my vocabulary, because the reality is I'm choosing to. I'm choosing to show up and meet my commitments. Lauren Bacon. People who are empowered in their romantic relationships can express needs and ask for them to be met. They can talk about problems. They can say what works for them and expect that their partners will try to accommodate for their needs as much as they can. It's not possible to make a person feel empowered, just as it's not possible to make a person feel secure. The best we can hope to do is to create an environment that welcomes participation and encourages empowerment. We can, however, disempower people, and that can be very dangerous. As we hope, the previous chapters impressed upon you. People who are disempowered have little to lose by breaking the rules. The worst possible outcome, losing the relationship, is something they're already risking by chafing under restrictions. By this point, losing the relationship might not seem like such a bad idea. Some key defining elements of empowerment in a romantic relationship are engaging and participating in the decision-making process for decisions that affect you. Having a full range of options available when decisions are made, not simply yes or no option, or in extreme cases, the accept it or leave option. Having agency over one's own body, relationship, and life. Being able to express needs, opinions, desires, and boundaries. Having access to the information that material affects your relationship, person, safety, or security. Being able to propose alternatives. Having the ability to object to and open negotiations about rules, agreements, or structures of the relationship. Having the ability to give, withhold, or withdraw consent. It's no coincidence that many of these characteristics resemble some of the relationship rights. When we use these criteria to define empowerment, it can become clear that an empowered relationship is not necessarily one which everyone has equal power. Rather, is one in which no one is disempowered, intentionally or unintentionally, by a hierarchical structure. Empowerment is not equality. When you bring up the notion of poly relationships without hierarchy, people often imagine you're talking about equal relationships, where equal means everyone has the same things. That might mean, for example, trying to create a relationship structure in which everyone has the same amount of time, the same status, or the same resources. Perhaps it means everyone is having sex with everyone else, everyone lives under the same roof, or everyone loves everyone else equally. You will hear people argue for hierarchical polyamory on just these grounds. It's not reasonable, they'll say, to give the long-distance boyfriend you've been dating for a year the same influence over major decisions as you give your wife. And that's usually true. But as we've said, we find it more useful when thinking of alternatives to hierarchy to speak of empowerment. This means full opportunity to voice needs, negotiate agreements, and advocate for building the kind of relationship you want. Because different people want different things, empowerment is more useful than sameness as a relationship principle. To continue our garden metaphor, attempting to build relationships where everyone is equal is a bit like lopping the top half off pine trees and placing rose bushes in the pots on tall pedestals to make everything the same height. What if one person naturally wants more time with a shared partner and another less? Is it reasonable to tell them both they're only allowed to have the same amount of time? What if one relationship has existed for 6 years, another for 6 months? Expecting the same level of commitment and entwinement from each would be high-order foolishness. Vesna story. Vesna lives with her partner, Ahmed, and she has been in a relationship with Aaron for more than a decade. She has also become close friends and occasionally lovers with Aaron's wife, Georgina. Vesna and Aaron clicked powerfully the first day they met, and their connection has endured not just across the years, but across several hundred miles that now separate them. But their relationship isn't suited to an entwined live-in situation. They're too much alike. Vesna says, it's just a kind of relationship she's never craved with Aaron. So despite their close bond, they live apart, each with nesting relationships of their own. None of them planned their relationships to be this way. For example, Aaron and Georgina never had agreement that Aaron couldn't form a life entwinement partnership with someone else. And Vesna is open to the possibility of having more than one such relationship at a time. The current arrangement is just the way things developed, a way that expresses the differently compatible personalities of everyone involved. Vesna describes every one of these relationships as remarkably low stress. She says it helps that her relationships, and most of her social circle, are queer, poly, and feminist. They talk a lot, and they have a shared language for doing so. She feels their involvement with kink helps them on its focus with negotiation. Vesna says, I love the synergy with which all this comes together in how my life and relationships are constructed. Eve and Franklin each have one partner we live with, and other partners who are highly independent and choose not to share a home with us, or anyone else. They prefer living alone. A literal take on equality might be that everyone should have the same obligations to share a home and same vote in how to handle a mortgage. A more rational take on equality might mean that everyone has equal power to choose how they run their lives. A partner who doesn't live with us might, for example, someday ask, I would like to consider sharing a home with you. How do you feel about that? But would not have an equal say in whether we decide to sell the house we currently live in. People who have long been together often have a vested sweat equity in the relationship. They've made sacrifices and incurred obligations together. Those obligations look like the big commitment arrows on the illustration in Chapter 11 of the paperback and digital versions of this book. In an empowered relationship, a person is not told, you have the same standing and same voice in these existing obligations and responsibilities. Rather, the person is told, as you invest in the relationship, you too will build sweat equity. You will not be denied the opportunity to do this. In the context of polyamory, an empowered relationship means that no one outside a relationship has the authority to place restrictions on that relationship. The flows of connection, commitment, and power within a relationship can be of any size and can even be unequal within relationships. But the defining element of hierarchy, power from within one relationship that controls or restricts another relationship, is absent. Franklin's partner Amy likes to say that empowered poly relationships are not ones where every person is equal to every other, but rather relationships in which you are negotiating from an equal footing with your partner. That is, third parties, such as your partner's other partners, do not have more power in your relationship than you do. We've seen cases where equality meant equality of bad behavior. Franklin knows a married couple who had opened their marriage to polyamory. The wife had a girlfriend for many years before the husband finally found another partner. When the husband started dating, the wife became increasingly jealous. Finally, after several months, she told her husband, I can't do this anymore. I want you to break up with your girlfriend. But it's okay, I will break up with my girlfriend too, so it's fair. This might be an extreme example, but the impulse often exists when we're faced with unpleasant emotions to treat people as expendable. Owning your power. Non-monogamous relationships clearly highlight the gap between our perception of our power and the reality of our power. It is often easier to see someone else's power than to see our own. If our partner begins a new relationship, we might see how he invests in the new relationship, and we feel powerless, without recognizing how established structures, history, commitments, and shared life experiences in our own relationship gives us a tremendous amount of power that the newer partner doesn't have. The new partner, however, is often keenly aware of the power the existing partner has. A key to practicing empowered relationships is to recognize and understand the power we hold. For this, we need to return to the ideas about security and worthiness in Chapter 4. Without a strong internal sense of security and worthiness, we will find it nearly impossible to be aware of our power in romantic relationships. When we feel unworthy, we feel disconnected, even when our loved ones are craving a connection with us. We feel isolated and alienated, even when we're surrounded by love and support. While we're working on the project of our own worthiness, though, we also need to seek to understand our own power, even if we don't yet feel it in our hearts. Here, to go back to our mushroom hunting metaphor, we look for evidence. If you are terrified of losing a 10-year relationship, step back and think about the fact that your partner has chosen to be in a relationship with you for 10 years. This didn't happen by accident. It happened because for 10 years, you have added value to your partner's life. If you feel you need a hierarchy to protect a co-parenting relationship, think about what it means that your partner has chosen to make the enormous commitment of having children with you, and look at evidence she gives you daily in the form of care and investment in your children. Practice gratitude for all of the ways, large and small, your partner invests in your relationship. it will help you understand the value of the relationship to them. Starting new relationships in the face of existing commitments. When starting a new relationship, it's important to be forthright and clear with the new person about your existing commitments. In fact, demonstrating that you keep your commitments to others is a good way to show a new partner that you are worthy of his trust and investment as well. But remember, there's more than one way to shave a walrus. Most polycommitments should offer multiple paths to meeting those commitments while still making room for new partners. Agreements to support existing commitments succeed best when they offer flexibility about how the commitments are met. First and foremost, flexibility honors the agency of the people involved. An agreement to meet your obligations to pay the mortgage offers more flexibility than a rule that you may never spend more than $30 on a date, even if the purpose of the rule is to make sure the mortgage gets paid. A flexible agreement spells out the nature of the obligation and empowers adults to make decisions as they see fit, so long as the obligation is met. Flexibility also allows for renegotiation of agreements, including the ways in which commitments are met when new relationships alter the playing field. We aren't suggesting, of course, that someone who begins dating a partner already in a long-term relationship be given the keys or invited to sign the mortgage on the first date. Instead, relationships usually work best when the newcomer is not forbidden in advance from doing such things ever, but rather knows that the situation has room to evolve. As with everything in polyamory, flexibility is key. Empowered relationships and children. Children are the most important commitment many people will ever make. If you're a parent now, they are probably the most important things in your life. Children are dependent. They need people to take care of them, and their parents need to prioritize meeting those needs. Only slowly do they develop good judgment and free agency and decision-making power on their way to adulthood. So they need special consideration and protection for many years. These overriding needs can get in the way of adult partnerships, which is tough. If you have or want children, you are likely and hopefully to choose partners who understand this fact. So surely, given the unique vulnerability of children, hierarchy must be necessary for polyfamilies with kids, right? Surely, as someone we know put it, coupled with kids, especially young kids, is intrinsically a hierarchical situation. No way around it. And without some guidelines or structure, the hierarchy can descend into chaos and the kids would suffer. Are empowered poly relationships even possible with children? Clara's story. When Clara and Elijah decided to open their marriage, their two children were very young, one a toddler. They did not enact a hierarchy before opening their relationship, but adopted open communication as their main strategy. Instead of rules, restrictions, or veto power, they agreed that if one of them was having trouble with another relationship, they would negotiate a solution case by case. Their children meant that time management was a central concern. As part of their agreement to open up, Elijah agreed to take on more of the household responsibilities to fill in when Clara was away with another partner. Clara became involved with Raymond, who had three children, with his wife, Caitlin. With Elijah and Caitlin's help, Raymond and Clara worked out a schedule for seeing each other that involved minimal time away from their children. Caitlin often took her children away from home on short trips and to visit family, allowing Clara to spend the night with Raymond alone in a quiet house. Because Elijah worked early in the morning, Clara needed to be at the house before he left. She left her own house after her children were asleep and returned in the morning before they woke up. Raymond would also occasionally spend the night at Clara and Elijah's home. Just as many monogamous people do, Clara waited to introduce Raymond to her children until she was certain their relationship had staying power, rather than asking her non-co-parenting partners to babysit, or requiring it, as discussed in service secondaries. She prefers to rely on friends. She also makes sure to schedule time alone with her children, so they can understand how much she values her relationship with them, and they never feel like Raymond is taking her away. As far as we know, no magic pixie dust gets sprinkled on parents at the moment of their child's birth to make them incapable of honoring commitments and responsibilities on their own. If you were a responsible adult before your kids were born, you will remain a responsible, if highly sleep-deprived, adult after. Responsible adults do not secretly want to ignore their children's well-being so badly that, if not for hierarchy, that's what they do. If people can be trusted to make good decisions in other realms of life, such as friendship, employment, or hobbies, they can be trusted in their romantic relationships. We have the optimistic view that if you are given the ability to make your own choices, you will honour your agreements, uphold your responsibilities, and care for the people you love, partners and children. Perhaps the best way for parents to work towards stable and loving homes is to seek partners who are other mature grown-ups and share their values and priorities. Then work to build a strong foundation to all their relationships, demonstrate over time that they are reliable and trustworthy, and then trust each other to make decisions that will benefit their relationship and their families. In empowered relationships, when a co-parent is about to make a choice that another parent doesn't feel is best for the family, she can raise her concerns. The adults can talk about the concerns and make their choices with those concerns in mind. If one person in the partnership begins consistently making choices that aren't best for the family, then it may be time to reevaluate that partnership, just as happens in monogamous relationships. And just as happens in monogamous relationships, sometimes the best thing for everyone may be for the parental dyad to share parenting some other way, such as living apart or in a live-in platonic co-parenting relationship, an arrangement we've seen often among poly people. If you don't like how someone is or isn't honouring their commitments to you, or you don't feel like they can be trusted to honour their commitments, and you can't talk it through with them, then they may not be a good choice as a co-parent. If an adult is willing to abandon her commitments, then hierarchy isn't going to force her to keep them. So what happens if the original parenting dyad does dissolve? Surely this scenario must be prevented at all costs if there are kids involved, right? Relationships end. In a family with children, the end of a relationship will be sad and stressful for everyone. But the same thing happens in monogamous families, and there are ways to minimize the stress on the children. Often, in fact, a new relationship created with more recent partner is more beneficial for a child than its parents' relationship was, if the parents' relationship was dysfunctional. We've seen this with monogamous blended families, as well as poly families. Game changes, discussed in the next chapter, happen to everyone, not just poly people. Sometimes children are affected. Clara's story. Clara and Raymond's relationship was a game changer for both of them. Raymond raised the bar for her in terms of what she wanted out of relationships, and in the end, her relationship with Elijah did not survive, nor did Raymond's with Caitlin. Clara and Raymond are now separated from their spouses and living with each other. It's always hard for the kids when parents separate, but all four parents have worked hard to minimize the effects of the separation on their children. Clara and her children still live at the same home as before, and their schedules have remained the same. Elijah comes to visit them two nights a week, and they spend the night with him every Saturday. This is less than he used to see them, and the elder child has experienced some grief at seeing her father less often. Raymond and Caitlin's children live with Caitlin and visit Raymond several times a week, including overnights. They have had a rougher time with their parent separation than have Clara and Elijah's children, because they are somewhat older, with a better grasp of the situation, and have overheard conversations that have exposed them to some of Caitlin's emotional distress. Both Clara and Raymond have experienced serious parental shaming from friends and family. Despite the struggles, Clara feels clear that she made the right decision. She believes that had she stayed with Elijah, her unhappiness would have undoubtedly affected her children. Many of us still carry an idea, preserved from the soulmate fairy tale, that a parental dyad is critical, often above all other concerns, for a child's well-being, even more important than family happiness or functionality. Many imagine that keeping someone in an unhappy relationship, for the sake of the children, is better than allowing two parents to live apart. We learned that from monogamous culture, after all. Among some poly people, this extends to a belief that it is dangerous to allow each adult to make her own choices in a way she needs, while also allowing her to honour her relationship and commitments as best she can. For a child, having happy, fulfilled parents who are committed to that child, in whatever configuration those parents come, and even if that configuration changes, and who are living lives that fulfill them, is far superior to having two parents who are together, dysfunctionally, only because rules and hierarchy keep them in line. And this situation is certainly better than having people in a household who are treated as secondary to other people. If children observe such behavior in their families, they will take those ideas out into the world and treat other people the same way. An empowered approach to polyamorous parenting might include agreements that look like this. I have chosen to parent with you, because you share my values and hopes, and I trust you to honour your commitments to me and make best decisions in your relationships that are best in the interests of our family. If your decisions do not support us, I will tell you how and why. I will trust you to work with me and your other partners, if necessary, to make it right. If you begin behaving in a way that is harmful to me, our relationship, or our child, and you don't rectify it, we will need to renegotiate the terms of our relationship and our co-parenting arrangement. It is absolutely true that guidelines and structure benefit children. They are naturally conservative creatures, thriving on order, predictability, and outside direction, and falling apart when given freedom they can't yet handle. Parents can create structure and prioritize their children without making one adult partner subject to restrictions created by another partner. Guidelines and structure can be achieved without hierarchy, because adults can be trusted to build a family out of goodwill, free choice, and their love for their partner and their child. Trust and courage. In Chapter 8, you met Myla, whose story we return to in Chapter 18. Myla, new to Polly and planning to have a child with her partner, found the idea of hierarchy seductive, but deliberately turned away from it because of her own values and her concerns for her partner and metamors. She worked through her fears and built a strong relationship with her partner Morgan based on trust. In Morgan's love and integrity and in her own ability to handle what came her way. Empowered relationships rely on trust. Trust your partner to want to cherish and support you. Trust that if you make your needs known, your partner will want to meet your needs. This requires courage. Building relationships on a shared understanding of needs means having courage to stand in the face of a negative emotion and ask, "What is this feeling telling me? Is there a need that is not being met? Is there something I can do to enlist my partner as an ally in dealing with this?" If you're the person whose partner is experiencing emotional hardship, it can be tempting to read this chapter as a way of saying, "You have the responsibility to deal with your own emotions, so I don't want you putting restrictions on me." That is partly true, in the sense that you can't solve someone else's problem for them, and if your partner places restrictions on your behavior, those restrictions rarely resolve the underlying issue. But it's a mistake to put what Douglas Adams calls a somebody else's problem field around a partner's distress. If you care, you will help. Behaving with compassion means working together to overcome relationship issues. That's how relationships become strong and healthy. Another valuable technique in the toolkit for strategies for happy, trusting relationships is to let go of attachment to the form that a partner's behavior must take. For example, suppose you feel you aren't getting enough time with your partner. One way to address this is to insist, for example, that he be home by 9 o'clock. This may or may not succeed. In one instance, Franklin has seen, it did not work even though the person did start coming home by 9, because he would then spend the rest of the evening talking or texting with the person he had just left. The partner who made the request had assumed that being home at 9 meant paying attention to her needs, but that wasn't what she actually asked for. What did work was junking the 9 o'clock rule in favor of a direct statement. "I need some of your undivided attention every day." When Franklin has a need, he tells his partners, "These are the things I need in order to feel loved and cherished. These are the things that make me feel special in your eyes." He says these things without expectation or compulsion. He says them without attachment to the way they have to happen. For example, he might say something like, "I feel loved and cherished when you spend time with me and reassure me whenever I feel threatened." And then he lets his partners do those things. Life is occasionally chaotic and unpredictable, from flat tires to late-night emergency room visits. Sometimes, even when we make a good-faith effort to meet our partner's needs, life gets in the way. Flexibility is important. Resiliency in the face of adversity is a powerful tool for building happy relationships. Questions to ask yourself. Empowerment in poly relationships and structures can be difficult to define, but its presence or absence is usually clearly felt. The following are some questions that can help you and your partners think about the level of empowerment in your relationships. How do I encourage decision-making participation by all my partners? In what ways do I show my partners they are empowered? If I feel a desire to restrict relationships between my partners and their partners, what underlying need am I trying to meet? What are my existing commitments? How can I meet them while still making room for new relationships? What evidence do I have that my partners love and care for me? Are there specific things I can ask my partner to do for me to help me feel loved and cared for? In what ways am I empowered in my relationships? What things help me to feel empowered? Can I renegotiate the agreements in my relationship? Can my partners? 14. Practical poly agreements. You cannot shake hands with a clenched fist. Indira Gandhi. Most relationships require some bare minimum of structure. Without it, it's difficult to navigate commitments and responsibilities. In the last few chapters, we talked about the distinctions between rules, boundaries, and agreements, and we made a case for why we think rules-based structures can create problems in poly relationships. Preparing the ground for relationships to flourish means thinking carefully, not just how to meet your needs, but how to meet the needs of all the people involved. In this chapter, we discuss practical strategies for approaching relationship agreements with this careful analysis as your foundation. It starts with thinking about why people do what they do. Here is Franklin's story.
Many years ago, I ran a small consulting business. I had an office in downtown Tampa, Florida. Every day on the way to the office, I drove past a building where people applied for passports. The application office was very small, with room for perhaps 5 people to sit inside. On most days, I would see at least 20 people outside waiting in line to get in. Just outside the building was a wall about 3 feet high. The people in line often sat on the wall. It's easy to understand why. They might have more than an hour's wait in the hot Florida sun. Whoever managed the passport office was offended by people sitting on the wall. I would see sheets of paper that read, "Do not sit on wall," taped to the wall. The signs were routinely ignored. The workers in the passport office didn't want people sitting on the wall, but they didn't think about why people sat on the wall. When you're waiting in a hot concrete courtyard for an hour, you're going to get tired and want to sit down. The rule was guaranteed to fail. A more effective way to prevent people from sitting on the wall, if that was really a problem, would have been to address the need rather than the action, say by installing benches. The memory of that office and its courtyard has stuck with me. In my own relationships, when I see people doing things I'd rather they didn't do, I try to find out why they're doing it and what might help take care of the need. I try to put benches in the courtyard rather than putting up signs telling them not to sit on the wall.
Effective relationship strategies take work. They are things that meet people's needs. And meeting these needs involves asking why people are doing whatever you wish they wouldn't. What need does their behavior meet? What function does it serve? Is there something else, something that might be less threatening, that could meet the same need? How invested is the person in doing that particular thing, and why? Creating such strategies also involves looking at some scary things inside yourself. Why is it not okay with you if that person does that thing? Are the problems you see really problems? Is passing a rule actually an attempt to shift responsibility for your own emotions onto someone else? Does the person doing the thing reasonably have a right to do it? How much does it really affect others, and in what way? Are you just trying to avoid discomfort? If so, is your discomfort more important than someone else's choices? From there, you can work on finding the park bench. What might help everyone get their needs met? If something makes you uncomfortable, how can the person do it and still support you? Why be skeptical of rules? Monogamous society teaches us that to keep our partners faithful and ourselves secure, we should limit their opportunity, keeping them away from desirable people. If that mindset carries over into poly, it leads to trying to keep ourselves secure by limiting who our partners are allowed to have relationships with, or how much time they can be together, or what they do. If we're setting these rules because we're afraid, deep inside, that we aren't good enough and our partners might replace us, a self-reinforcing cycle can develop. We feel low self-esteem, so we make rules to feel safe. And then we don't want to develop self-esteem because if we do that, we won't need rules anymore. And if we don't have rules, we won't feel safe. Sometimes we can try to use rules to address things we are shy about discussing. It feels scary to talk about our vulnerabilities and insecurities. Often, talking about rules becomes a way to try and do that by proxy. It doesn't work because if we can't talk about the reason for the rule, our partners won't understand the rule's intent, and that leads to trouble, mischief, and rules lawyering, insisting on the letter of the rule without being clear on the intent. Not all rules are intrinsically bad. See, for instance, limited duration rules previously in this book. However, rules have always the potential to become straitjackets, constraining relationships and not allowing them to grow. Sometimes this is intentional, and such rules can be very damaging indeed. If your partner tells you, "I don't want you to ever grow any new relationship beyond this point," and eventually a relationship comes along that you want to see flourish, your original relationship may fail. Not in spite of the rule, but because of it. Rules that seek to dictate the structure of a relationship that is yet to exist, for example, "We will only be in a quad," are attempts to map a country you have not yet seen. These types of rules, we have seen, are most often created by people with little experience in polyamorous relationships. Often, they attempt to impose order on something that seems mysterious and dangerous. Psychologists have discovered that we are remarkably poor at predicting how to respond to novel situations. We want certainty. We don't want to get too far from familiar land. But we cannot explore the ocean if we're unwilling to lose sight of the shore. Trying to retain the certainty and order of monogamy against the apparent scary disorder of polyamory usually ends up in creating failures in both. Some rules indicate fears or discomforts that someone doesn't want to face. Someone might say, "We want to have other partners, but the thought of my partner prioritizing anyone else when I want attention brings up my fears of abandonment. So, we will pass a rule saying I can always interrupt my partner's other dates, or I must approve my partner's scheduled time with other people." When two or more people have discomforts they're trying to avoid, they may play the mutual assured destruction game. "I will let you control me to avoid your discomforts if you let me control you to avoid my discomforts." Or as the polyblogger Andrea Zanin has written, "I will limit you and you will limit me, and then we'll both be safe." Avoiding discomfort isn't really the same thing as creating happiness. Real happiness is often on the other side of our comfort zone. If our relationships aren't creating happiness, what's the point? Note, however, that restrictions on sex in a shared bed are a very common limited duration rule, discussed in Chapter 10. Creating effective relationship agreements. Agreements and boundaries will be part of any polyamorous relationship. Some expectations are reasonable, though. Reasonable and unreasonable carry a great deal of wibbly-wobbly subjectivity. Here is one of the crude telltale signs of unreasonable rules that we use. When people have agreements that are reasonable, such as around safer sex, they generally can talk about them calmly and dispassionately. When someone states a rule and then refuses to discuss it, answers questions about it with, "That's just how I feel," or becomes offended or upset about it, look out. Something else is going on, something that isn't being addressed directly. Healthy agreements are those that encourage moving in the direction of greatest courage. "I feel threatened by the idea of my woman having sex with other men." "She can't do that." It's based on fear and insecurity, not courage. "I feel threatened by this idea, so when you do this, I will ask for your support, and I'll want some time with you afterward to help ground and settle me," is a request that moves in the direction of greatest courage. It recognizes that the other person has the right to choose her partners, while at the same time asking for the support and help to deal with the unpleasant emotional responses. The agreements that work most consistently are those that are rooted in compassion, encourage mutual respect and empowerment, and leave it to our partner's judgment how to implement them, and have input from and apply equally to everyone affected by them. These include principles like the following. Treat all others with kindness. Don't try to force relationships to be something they're not. Don't try to impose yourself on other people. Understand when things are not about you. Understand that just because you feel bad, it doesn't necessarily mean someone else did something wrong. Know that your feelings sometimes lie to you. Own your mess. Favor trust over rules. Here are some other common characteristics of successful relationship agreements. They're not games of Mao, named for Chinese ruler Mao Zedong. Mao is a card game where at the start of the game, none of the players except the dealer know the rules, and the players are penalized for breaking the rules. The players who figure out the rules the slowest lose. If you are to have relationship agreements, they must be clear and comprehensible. Everyone involved should know and understand them, and equally important, understand the intent behind them, the spirit, as well as the letter. They seek to place controls on oneself, not one's partners. You can't really control anyone but yourself. You must, you cannot. Those kind of statements work only if the other people choose to let them. They offer a clear path to success. Rules that try to protect anyone from ever feeling uncomfortable, for instance, don't have a clear path to success. Discomfort often accompanies change, and sometimes attempting to prevent one person from being uncomfortable will make someone else uncomfortable. They are clear, specific, and limited in scope. "You must care for me more than you care for her" is not clear or specific. It doesn't define what "care for me" means, or what steps can be taken to get there. "We will not have unbarriered exchange of bodily fluids before discussing it with each other" is clear, specific, and limited in scope. They have a defined practical purpose. "Don't do this because it makes me feel threatened" is vague and impractical. It places responsibility for the feeling on the partner of the person having the feeling. It's not always clear what need a particular feeling may be trying to communicate, and it can take some effort to work down from a feeling to discover the underlying need. Successful agreements address needs directly, rather than trying to address feelings about them. They do not seek to sweep problems under the rug. "I get jealous when I see you kiss someone, so don't kiss anyone in front of me" does not deal with the jealousy. It only addresses the trigger. The jealousy is still there, just waiting to emerge in some other way. They have a sunset clause if they are meant to provide space for dealing with a problem. A sunset clause means a restriction expires on a certain date. If there is no sunset clause, once the emotional trigger has been removed, it can be all too easy to say, "I'll work on the problem tomorrow." And tomorrow becomes next week, and then next month. They aren't aimed at unspoken expectations. For example, "Don't spend the night at a lover's house" may actually be a way of saying, "Make sure I'm never lonely." The overnight rule might sound reasonable, but the underlying expectation is not. We are human beings. We feel many things, including, from time to time, things we don't like, such as loneliness. They are renegotiable. Any agreement should be open to discussion at any time by anyone it affects. This includes anyone who enters a relationship after an agreement is made. Life is change. Deal with it. Even if life never changed, we rarely build something exactly right the first time. They do not disempower people. It's common for a couple or people in a romantic network to pass rules governing in advance the behavior of a future new arrival, without giving that person a say. In ethical relationships, every adult has a voice. They do not try to legislate feelings. People cannot provide feelings on demand. Attempting to legislate feelings, for example by saying, "You must love both of us equally," or "You are not allowed to feel jealous," usually works about as well as trying to legislate the weather. Negotiating in good faith. When you are negotiating agreements in your relationship, it can be hard to hear that your partners have different needs or sensitivities than you do. Truly understanding that other people are as real as you is hard. If you want to negotiate in good faith, here are some things to keep in mind. Focus on mutual benefit. To succeed, an agreement must benefit everyone, even when people have what seem to be contradictory goals. It may be possible to find a solution by looking for the need underneath a proposed rule. Pay attention to the needs. If a partner tells you, "I don't want you to take any dates to Bob's Crab Shack, because that's a special place for the two of you," their statement may spring from a desire to feel unique in your eyes. Finding ways to show your partner that you consider him unique and irreplaceable may solve the need better than avoiding Bob's Crab Shack. Treat other people in the negotiation as partners, not problems. It's easy to think, "If only you would do what I say, everything would be okay. Why aren't you doing what I want?" Remember that these people are not your adversaries. You all want happy relationships. Treat people with compassion. Don't compromise on behalf of other people without their input and consent. When you agree to limitations on your actions with other people, you are limiting them as well. They deserve a place at the negotiating table. When you didn't write the rules. In polyamory, you will likely find yourself starting relationships with people who already have partners. And that may mean going into relationships that have rules already in place. Accepting someone else's rules at the beginning of a relationship sets a dangerous precedent. It says that you're on board with relationships that are built around other people's needs. Anyone who goes into a rules-based relationship, knowing the rules up front, is agreeing voluntarily to be bound by them, right? Well, maybe. All kinds of things might cause someone to enter a relationship that isn't a good fit. A scarcity model of relationships, for example. It's absolutely true that if you enter a rules-based relationship, you are, implicitly and explicitly, agreeing to those rules. And yet, you knew the rules when you signed on, is so often the parting shot amidst a relationship's wreckage. Consider why. Most of the time, when we start a relationship, we expect our partners to meet us in the middle, to negotiate with us, to consider our needs. Those seem like reasonable expectations, right? So, it can be quite a shock when your partner suddenly slams the door on something and says, it's non-negotiable. What is it about this Bob's Crab Shack anyway? Why can't I go there with you? I just want to get some seafood. Rules might seem reasonable at first, but end up leading to absurd outcomes. In one relationship we know of, a married couple had rules concerning what sexual positions could and couldn't be used with new partners. When the wife started a relationship with someone else, those rules remained in force a decade into the new relationship. I think most of us would probably agree that a 10-year relationship is not a new relationship. We would probably expect, reasonably, that if a rule takes us to an absurd destination, it should be revisited. And we can be shocked to be met with, nope, sorry, you knew the rule when you signed on. It is okay to assume that flexibility and agency in our relationships are part of the social contract. It probably wouldn't occur to us to have to say, by the way, I've been with you for 10 years. I expect you to be willing to consider my needs. So in that sense, you knew the rules when you signed on. It's not actually true. We did not grasp that flexibility and negotiation were forbidden. At the beginning of a relationship, we can't predict what feelings we will have or how deeply we will attach to someone because we aren't there yet. Therefore, it's easy to say yes to rules that treat us as disposable or don't give us a voice in advocating for our needs because we don't have the needs yet. The true test of compassion is what we do when compassion is hard.